My name is Sasha, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics may participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would be also helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Kareth and Gerard, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that you learn here. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Mary will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Mary. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Deborah will read the steps.
My name is Deborah. I'm an alcoholic. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Patrick will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Patrick. I'm an alcoholic. 12 traditions. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He has expressed Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Lest problems of money, property, or prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional. but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Sarah.
Hi, guys. My name is Sarah, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow. I think it's weird about recovery is nobody tells you how you start to feel all these things once you get in here and you can't numb out. And I just prayed with like 5 different people and told everyone I was speaking and they're all excited and this just isn't my life. But I guess it is. I'm stoked. I'm going to start off with the stats. My sobriety date is June 15th, 2009. My sponsor is Hannah. Atlanta Group is my home. I am working on step 9, practicing 10, 11, and 12 daily. I think it's important to hear stats of people because, you know, we end up working this program. It's not fake. I'm not just kind of coasting through this. I'm doing work. Start off with my glamorous drinking career. One of the first times I remember getting drunk was after my grandfather had passed, and I was close with him, and I had seen a lot of family members drinking and using drugs to get through it, so I decided to follow suit. Recently, I was in a new high school, and I was trying to make new friends, and I felt so uncomfortable and that nobody liked me. So I was invited to this party, and I was like, all right, this is going to be like my coming out. Everyone's going to love me. I'm going to be great. I'm walking to this party. My skin feels so tight, it's going to crack, and my heart is pounding so hard. I can't hear anything. I walk in, go straight to the kitchen, start doing shots with all the guys, and I'm immediately loved by everyone, which I made up in my own head. Fast forward 15 minutes later, I'm rolling around on the ground with my friend, and we feel great. I feel amazing for the first time until I start feeling like I need more of this. This isn't enough. If I can feel this good, I can feel better in a hot second. So I turn my friend, like, let's go drink some more. And she's like, I'm done. I don't think so. And I walk back in there, and I start doing more shots with the guys because drinking them under the table was cool and classy. And then I'm in a blackout. And that was the beginning of a cyclical thing for me. It's just when I drank, I blacked out. So I don't have a fun drunk log. I don't remember a lot of things. But it never stopped me. I woke up the following morning completely embarrassed, afraid of what I had done, of who I'd hurt. And I was like, I can't do that again. That was really scary. Next week, I did the same thing. And I think that's really common in alcoholics because we forget how bad it is and just go right back to it. So after that, I had gotten a job bartending because I could feed my craving with other alcoholics. And I lived in a party house where I could play bartender and I could be near the alcohol all night. So I didn't have an excuse like, oh, I'm not going to drink as much because I'm not near it. Instead, I'm pouring you drinks and taking 3 times as many as I'm serving. Blackouts every time. I never drink alone because I never wanted to feel alone the next morning when that whole remorse and wanting to die feeling set in. But the truth was, I was always alone in the morning because no one ever drank as much as I did. It was just me. I never saw this as a problem. I never saw blacking out as not normal, even though I'd ask my friends, they're like, no, I remember everything. I constantly wanted to die, and I was extremely young, and that's not okay. I moved to New York, and I really feel like my alcoholism kind of took off. I came here for college, and it was like orientation week, and it was really just surrogate drunk week. I think I went to 2 mandatory things so I could get it checked off so I could start classes. I didn't meet anyone. I didn't try to make friends with anyone. I was too busy trying to hang out with all the cool New Yorkers and be awesome and fit in with older people because that's who I was at 19. My drinking became more often, never alone, but more often with roommates. I was trying to drink to hide away from people. I constantly lied about it because I wanted to come off as perfect and normal. But inside, I was like decaying. It's just I couldn't put myself together, but I could fake it really well to everyone else. Just kind of fast forward to my last night drinking. I was really looking forward to an unlimited mimosa brunch because I had ruined all friendships around me, and I was like, once I start with those mimosas, I'm going to be golden because I don't feel anything then. So there we go, start going at it and make myself puke to drink more, which isn't normal. And then we finish up there because we get kicked out. And I'm like, let's go to a hotel and drink more and have tons of fun. And it wasn't tons of fun. I had gotten into fights. I had embarrassed myself. I had done shameful things. At no point in time did I stop drinking. I was like, just more, more, more. Laying on the ground, having it poured in my mouth. Like, I couldn't even put glass to mouth anymore. Normal, right? Like, every night I drank, I cried a lot. I got lost, and I would drunk down my dad at 4 in the morning to come pick me up on a work night. He came and got me, and he smelled the alcohol on me and said, Sarah, haven't you had enough? And at this point, I took it personally. I was like, enough? No way. And I then got into a fight with him and severed my ties with him. This is my father, my best friend, the only person who's ever been here for me. I woke up the next morning feeling the worst that I've ever felt in my life. I didn't want to wake up anymore. And this was like the last thing, and I was like, okay, I have to do something positive. I have to. So I contacted a friend who I knew was in AA, and I met her outside of the Monday night AG meeting, and I've been here ever since. I got a sponsor my first night. I was instructed to call her every day, pick up the phone when it rang, be honest with my emotions, get the big book in the 12 and 12, and get to town on my first assignment. I never dragged my feet with this program. I met with her multiple times a week because I needed to feel better. I needed to know that everyone who's smiling and happy around me, that this was true, that I could have this. It wasn't just for certain people who looked really great and had good jobs. It could be for the disheveled person that I thought I was. So I worked the steps quickly, and I was really honest, and I am so grateful for that, because if I didn't, I wouldn't have stayed. I am completely self-centered, and all I ever do is think about myself, and doing the work helps me get out of myself and to realize that I have similar patterns and situations, and when I stop doing that, I'm of maximum usage to other people. I can help others. And when I'm helping others, I'm not thinking about myself, and I never thought that that's what the case would have been when I was here. My first Tuesday here, I heard people talking about sponsoring and helping others, and I was like, no way. This is all about me. A year and a few months later, and all I want is a sponsee. All I want is to give this away. I was kind of on this AA pink cloud for a while, and I loved it, and I was, you know, part of it. I had commitments, I was fellowshipping, I was going to meetings all the time. And then because I was doing this, my life got big. I graduated college, I finally got a job, I'm self-supporting, I'm doing things that I love because of this program. And like everyone says, you begin to forget that you have this life because you're here. And I need to put in more time and effort into my program, because if I don't, it's gonna be gone. I'm gonna be back, you know, a year and a few months ago crying every day. I don't want that. I would like to speak to people who, you know, are working the steps and kind of feel a little uncomfortable, because that's exactly where I'm at right now. And I know that I'm being told to talk to more people, to be honest, to help newcomers. And I'd like you to know you're not alone, because I feel like nobody really speaks about when you get uncomfortable and want to, you know, not be honest about it. This is still petrifying minutes in, guys. Steps, newcomers. If you're new, stay. Get real. Get honest. Get a sponsor. Do something. Do the first positive thing for yourself and ask for help, and just get to town. Stop messing around and thinking that things are ever going to get better when you're out there, because it's not true. There's multiple people in here who can tell you all about going out and coming back in, and it sucks. Just stick with it. The steps are really just beyond amazing, because you have a life after it. And like, once you understand that you're suffering from a sickness of mind and body, it becomes a lot easier to start working on it and to start, you know, finding a higher power of your own understanding, which may seem petrifying because it still is for me from time to time. But having a dependence upon something other than yourself is really comforting. Once you realize that it's not you running the show, you're golden. I know I'm still really self-centered because I'm sitting here thinking about what you all are thinking of me, which means I have a lot of work to do, and I have a minute left, and I really didn't think I'd be able to fill 10 minutes. I think if I can just leave you with one thing, is just don't give up on this, because it works, and it's not crap that people spew to you from here. It really does. Just put some time and effort into it, and you're going to be great. So start working on yourself and do some change, because life is great. Thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Craig.
Hi, my name is Craig, and I'm an alcoholic. This is great. I'd like to thank Eddie for asking me to speak tonight, and thank the group. I've been a member here since February of last year, I think it was, something like that. And this is extremely an honor, and to be able to be up here where other people have been that I've admired, you know, what they've said. So hopefully, I make some sort of sense here myself. I'm going to speak about what it was like, how I got here, and you know what it's like now. Thank God, because I couldn't really speak about what I did when I was drunk, because I had the same disease she had, which Sarah had, which was I blacked out. Except mine were more of a strobe light, because it would like begin as a. I would have a couple of cocktails at dinner, and then all of a sudden I'd be driving 100 miles an hour down the road. Or there'd be a cop behind me pulling me over for drunk driving. Or I'd be, you know, on top of a huge building. Who knows? But that's where I went. It just, and I never got fearful of it. And I never passed out, which was the scariest part. You know, I had to live through all of those experiences. So my drinking story is more of rumors and innuendos, you know. So what I can tell you, though, is that I started drinking when I was younger. I had my parents had, you know, one family. My mother had the family that didn't drink at all. And then my father had the family that drank all the time. And whenever we had parties, it was always the big party at my grandmother's side or grandfather's side. And they would drink all the time. And I don't remember them buying all the booze, but I remember serving it. You know, when I was a little kid, I'd be running around, and I'd be serving them beer and mixed drinks and whatnot, and I would be taking the sips of them. And I thought, oh, this is really fun, you know, and trying to get away with it. And the other side, my mother's side, you know, my grandfather would give me, you know, little shots of wild turkey, and I would think, wow, now I'm a grown-up. But on the other side, I thought I was, you know, a child running around getting away with something. So, but I didn't drink heavily until, you know, I drank until I blacked out. And that was you know, at 13. And it was an experience. And then it just continued on, you know, through school, all the way through. I was one of those at-leasters. At least I showed up. At least I turned the paper in. At least I did something. And, you know, I got through school, and that was good. You know, that was healthy. And then I got married and had two kids. And during that period of time, my father had been drinking, you know, constantly. And now I see it as, I used to use it as an experience. As an example. You know, a lot of times people say, don't put your finger in a light socket. And then somebody does it and you figure out that's the wrong thing to do. But if you do something bad, or, you know, like I'll just use smoking, you know, people say not to smoke, but everyone does. But you do it by example. My father drank a lot, and I saw how he was, and how he stumbled, and how he fell. Oh, and how he fell. You know, he urinated on the floors, would get out of the car and scoot off. And every time I would drink, I would never remember doing that, so I was never that bad. So he ended up stopped drinking. And then I got married, had two kids. One daughter had a severe illness. And she was supposed to die. And my father came up all every day, and he brought a rose, a single rose, and he always was there, and he always talked to me. And everyone else who came in was more concerned about themselves. And he was like there, he was like the rock. And I didn't give it much thought until I came into the program. But anyway, she did live. And which is always good, for the most part. It's always good to live. But on the inside, I was dying. I stopped drinking during that 1 year in the hospital because I knew I couldn't make a decision because I knew that I would make wrong decisions because alcohol was driving it. I wasn't an alcoholic at the time, but I knew that alcohol caused problems. And then as soon as she got out of it, I would continue drinking. You know, I picked it up right where I was. And, wow, we're quick. All right. So, long story short, moved to Connecticut and I got divorced. I should mention that I got a drunk driving ticket at one point because I always forget that. And then the last part is I went from being a guy in a suit all day long, could present himself to everybody, and I would end up in the basement drinking by myself out of bottles where it was warm vodka, nothing iced down, nothing, you know, it was not pretty. And I decided I had to stop. So I did. I used the example of my father again. He came into the program and he changed considerably. He was my rock when I had the issues. And so I used that as the example. And I went to the AA first time, went to the first meeting at 4 o'clock. I had one heck of a hangover. Oh, it lasted until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I went to my first meeting at 4. So it was good to go to an AA meeting without a hangover. And got to that one, got done at 5, went to another one. Ended up being a church choir practice. And so that didn't work out so well. And I went to my third meeting, which was really a meeting, and sat in the back, denial row, didn't want to say anything at all to anybody, went outside, and a guy came up to me and started talking to me. He was friendly. And he said his name was Ben, and what are you doing here? And I said, it was my first time. And he said, do you have a sponsor? And I said, no. So he became my sponsor. Asked me what I was doing in the morning, on a Saturday morning. Now, he was really nice, and I thought he was just trying to, I don't know. I thought he was lonely, you know. Give me a call tomorrow. Okay. What? Why? He said, I'd like to see how you're doing. I said, okay. So somebody I could help, you know. So I gave him a call in the morning, and he answered the phone. And I said, what are you doing on a Saturday morning at 6 o'clock in the morning? I go, nothing. And he said, I'm picking you up. We're going to a meeting. And we went down to Westport. It was a 40-minute trip, and we had a coffee commitment for 13 years through whatever. And what we did is he started going through the steps. First thing, you know, the advantage that we had is we had a lot of time in the car, those 40 minutes, and I didn't realize that was his ploy. Because we know he had a ploy. Because every sponsor I found out, you know, in my own head, you know, some sort of ploy. But it's really to help the newcomer. Whatever we do, you know, the nice, being on the side of being a sponsor, I know it. Because it's so unselfish. You can be so unselfish being a sponsor. And I now know exactly what he was doing. And again, he led by example. So now I can follow his example. But he took me down 40 minutes. we talked about personal stuff and blah, blah, blah. And then he asked me stupid questions like, how are you sleeping? I'm going, what do you care? But apparently sleep deprivation is normal, or you oversleep. How's the family? You know, what's the bank accounts like? You know, what's going on? You know, how are you set up? How's your job doing? And you know, I told him, you know, job sucks. I'm broke. Wife hates me. You know, is there anything else we can go through? You know, and as we went through it, we started going through the whole process of the steps. Now, in the big book, it says, wow, it says that we, by the time we're halfway done, you know, we'll see improvements. And I did. And I was so happy about it because I started changing the life around my family, my wife, my job. A year and a half later, my job said, you know, I don't know what happened to you, but a year and a half ago, we were going to fire you. And it was amazing that, you know, we didn't. And so I am very grateful to the meeting. I got a new sponsor when I moved in here. Again, I didn't choose my first one. I didn't choose my second one. And God gave me the best one I can ever have. And I'm so grateful to the meeting, so grateful to the group here, and happy to be part of it. Thank you very much.
Our main speaker tonight is Amanda.
Hi, I'm Amanda. I'm an alcoholic. It's really cool to be here. I want to thank Jeff for asking me to speak. I haven't been breathing for the last 30 minutes, so once my heart stop goes down, I'll be okay. My sobriety date is July 30th, 2000. I have a home group, which is the Atlantic group. I have a sponsor, who is Stephanie P. I have a few 9-step amends left, and I'm living in 10, 11, and 12, one day at a time. And I'm extremely grateful. I did not mean to get sober and stay sober. It was just an accident, you know, and it's like a lot of alcoholics die drunk. You know, a lot of alcoholics die without ever coming into an AA meeting, and this thing that scares me the most is that a lot of alcoholics die after they've come into an AA meeting. And I'm just incredibly grateful that the longer I stay sober, my enthusiasm and energy around Alcoholics Anonymous just continues to grow. You know, I got sober when I was 20. I picked up a drink when I was 15 years old. I was in my first AA meeting by 16. It wasn't going well right off the bat. And I had about 2 months of fun drinking. My first drink, it was all by myself. I decided, I wasn't at a party, I was just all by myself, decided that I was going to bring a beer to school and drink it. And I remember I was just bored in high school. And what I learned through my step work and being in AA, that being bored is another way of me saying I don't feel a part of anything and I'm lonely. It took me a while to figure that out because I was like, oh, I'm just bored. And so I brought it, I drank it, it was fourth period, I didn't get drunk, I didn't get buzzed, but what happened was is I had a nice little ease and comfort come over my body that I've never felt before. And, you know, I like to think, the reality is, like, me by myself alone, my default is paranoia and anxiety. And when I took that drink, it just went away. I didn't have to get drunk. That stuff just went away. I stopped worrying about stuff. I just was like, this is awesome. And I said out loud, like, this, I don't understand how people don't do this every single day. Like, that should have been a warning sign. I said this to my friend. She just kind of looked at me. We were in the library, and I said this. And you know, I was just in trouble, and I went off from there. I took that one drink. I don't remember what my second drink was. I don't remember what my third drink was. All I remember is maybe a couple drinks later, I was in, still 15 years old, a couple months later, I guess, I was in the garage of my house. My parents were working, and I'm drinking half a bottle of champagne by myself. I drank in school a lot in the beginning because I was afraid my mother was going to get caught. I was going to get caught by my mother, which doesn't make much sense because when you get caught in school, they tell your mother. And so I kept getting caught in school. But in school, high school was kind of cool. I was a really good athlete. I was a pretty good student. I had a great reputation with students and teachers and the staff. And they just had me doing everything. I was like making announcements during homeroom. I still am. I was making announcements. I was like president of my class. I was like running this thing. And I knew that because I was like, I had a great reputation, I can get away with a lot. So I kept drinking and getting caught, and I'd be like, oh, I'm sorry. And I thought I had them, but they really had me, because they saw me as someone who had a drinking problem. And I was like, whatever keeps me in school and keeps you from kicking me out or suspending me, let's go with it. Yes, I have a problem. And what I also did was, with this fabulous reputation I had, I stole a book of, like, passes, and I was forging teachers' names, and I was getting out of class, and I was getting my friends out of class, and I was the sports editor of our newspaper, The Chieftain, and we had our own little room, and I was one of the few people that had keys to it, and, like, I'd get myself out of class, and then I'd go into The Chieftain, and I'd drink, and I just had it going. My parents were going through a divorce at the time, and part of my alcoholism, I don't deal with anything. I just kind of like, I don't have an opinion on anything. I don't have any feelings for whatever reason. I have a brother who's a couple years older than me. You know, my parents sat us down, we're getting a divorce. My brother throws a huge temper tantrum, runs out of the house, throws himself on the floor. He's crying, and I just kind of look at them and was like, can I go watch TV? You know, and that was my reaction through all things in life. So the divorce had absolutely no effect on me at the time. I wasn't reacting to it, but I used it as an excuse to, like, get myself out of trouble. It was like, why are you drinking so much, man? It was like, well, things at home aren't okay, you know. And if you know my parents, they're the most loving people in the world. Like, yes, they're going through a divorce, but I saw my father every day. I saw my mother constantly. You know, I had no problems at home. You know, I was just using it, and it was working. And finally, it stopped working. I was 16. I was a junior. I got caught for the last time. They said, and right around this time, I was also like going into like a depression. Every time I drank, the next day I was like extremely depressed, and I was on the verge of being suicidal. And I was talking about it because of the drinking problems in school. I was forced to go to weekly guidance counselor meetings, and I was actually starting to come clean to the guidance counselor. I'm like, I don't want to live anymore. I'm just really depressed. You know, I don't know what it is. And if you looked at my, on paper, my life was fine. I really had no, you know, nothing bad was happening. So she sent me to a therapist. And I had this great basketball coach that took me to the therapist. She's like, you know, she went with me. I sat down, and I'm about to sit with this therapist and tell her that, like, my parents are divorced, I'm having a hard time, you know, and my basketball coach cuts me off. And she's like, she can't stop drinking, and she's drinking in school. And I was like, oh, come on, man. But I look back, it was such a God moment, because after that, I saw this therapist once a week, and eventually I broke down and was like, I just don't think there's anyone in the world that understands me, and that's how I really feel. And she goes, I know a whole bunch of people that do. And she hands me the meeting book for Nassau County AA. Like, she was, you know, I'm extremely grateful for her. My basketball coach took me to the AA meeting, and I went to two AA meetings. Obviously, I didn't stay. I don't remember any. I remember a very skinny drug addict getting a chip. That's what I remember from this meeting. And I left, and I continued to drink for another 3 years, about three and a half years. But I never drank the same. And what I do now as a result of those meetings is, someone comes to me from the outside thinking they have a drinking problem, I drag them to AA meetings, because if they're an alcoholic, I just ruin their drinking. And if they're not, they're going to go off and they're going to be just fine. And I've ruined a lot of people's drinking. I take satisfaction in it because mine was ruined. But I graduated high school and I went to school in the Bronx. And it was the greatest day on earth, because I was going to a great school. I was playing soccer. I had a scholarship. But that wasn't it. It was the Bronx. And it means that I can get alcohol whenever I want, anytime I want, at any place that I can walk into. I was growing up on Long Island, and it was a pain in the neck, and you had to drive to Queens to get alcohol. And it was just the panic that created driving to Queens. Like, did we buy enough? Are we good? Do we have enough? Can we get enough? Who's got the ID? It was like, I didn't have to go through that anymore. And that's why going to this school was amazing. And they had a beer distributor that you can get a 30-pack for $14. Like, I just thought it was heaven. And I had bodegas and with the high countertops, and I, like, you know, I'm a freshman. I look 12. I go into these bodegas. I have a book bag. I'm like small too. I have my book bag that looks bigger than me. It looked like I was going to kindergarten for the first time. And I go into the bodega and like hands stretched, I just throw 2 40s and a six pack across the counter. And slide my money across, and then I scoop it down, I put it in my bag, and I run back to this campus, and I just, what was happening, it was, I just couldn't stop drinking. And that was, you know, it was fun for a day in school, but I, now that I was like not getting caught in high school and I wasn't living with my parents, I went to town, and I could not stop drinking. Once I put a drink in my body, I could not stop drinking. I remember I was trying to write this paper for philosophy. It was an extra credit paper. I didn't even have to do it, but I was trying to help myself. And I was like, I'm just going to drink 2 of these 16 ounces. I'm going to write my paper. I'm going to control it, because if I get too drunk, I'm not going to be able to write it. You know, and I stuck to my 2. I wrote the paper. Once the paper was done, I drank like I usually drink. And I never woke up to hand the paper in. And it was like, you know, it was, I just want a couple of drinks, and then it was 4 a.m., and I'm making macaroni and cheese in my hot pot, and, you know. And long story short, I woke up in a lot of strange places with strange people in the Bronx. It was terrifying when I look back on it, and I'm just so, somebody was watching out for me. I blacked out a lot. I couldn't find my campus many times. And, you know, there was one night, I was on a soccer tournament. I wasn't drinking. And I say this like, I swear I wasn't drinking, because this is what the thing, I fell off my bed in the hotel room in the soccer tournament where we were staying, and people were like, man is drinking. I was like, I am not drinking. I fell off the bed. I'm sorry. And it cracked my head open, and I had stitches on my forehead. So I couldn't play. I couldn't play for the week. The next week, like, when I wasn't drinking, I was living on fear and fear alone. Fear, paranoia, anxiety, those are my things. And I still had the stitches in my head, and my coach goes, do you want to play? This was the following week, and I was too afraid to say no, because I wanted him to like me. I was terrified of people liking me. So I went in the game, and I got hit in the stitches, and I went down, and the ref is telling me to get off the field, and I'm just out of it. So I curse at the ref, because he's throwing me off the field, like, how dare you? You know, I had a little bit of an ego, too, and so, and then I get a red card, I get kicked out, and I get suspended. And my mom is at the game, and she just looked at me with begging me, like, can you please just come home so we can check your head out? Because I had head problems in the past with soccer. And she was like, just please come home so we can get some tests done and see a doctor. And I was about to say yes, and then I realized, like, I can drink now for this weekend, because we weren't allowed to drink on the weekends during soccer season. And the idea was, like, I can now drink Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday night during a soccer season. So I was like, no, I'll be okay, I'll stay. You know, and then Saturday night I went out, I drank, I fell, and I hit my head again. You know, and this is how I drank. You know, later on I broke my foot in a bar, I just fell. And this is what it was. You know, I lived with 7 other girls, and I there was one girl that drank just like me, but there was another girl that was my immediate roommate that she's still my best friend today, that was terrified, and she sat me down one day, and she got me in the right moment once again, where I was filled with just remorse and disgust with myself for what I did the night before. And she's like, I'm terrified, I don't know what's going to happen to you, and I can't hang out with you anymore because I can't handle it anymore. And it broke my heart, and I knew I had a problem with alcohol, but I knew there was nothing I could do. And I just kind of looked at her, and I continued to drink for another 6 months because I just didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to stop. And I had remembered those AA meetings, and I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew I had a drinking problem, but I had no idea what to do, and I didn't think I was ever going to be able to stop drinking. So it was like, I'm an alcoholic. There's nothing I could do. And I was starting to get panic attacks, night sweats. I had the shakes in the morning real bad. I had some lunatic alcoholic roommate that was like, oh, she just has the shakes because she's hungry, you know. And it was like, and even I knew that was like, no, not really. And I wanted to stop drinking now, but I just knew I just couldn't. And here I am, I'm 19 years old. I have a roommate that's like dreaming of going to med school, and I'm dreaming about a life without alcohol. And, you know, it just didn't make sense. And the one roommate that was like crazy alcoholic, like she was crazy. This is what I thought. She was crazy. I was just an alcoholic. And we were worried about her, so we went to a counselor at school to talk about her drinking. And it was, I sat there with my other roommates being like, yo, this girl needs help. You know, what are we going to do? Like, who do we hook her up with? And the next day, I was like taking it serious. My roommate, the one that was honest with me and my best friend, was like, you're just as bad as she is. And it was a smack in the face. Because I looked at this girl like, oh my God, this girl needs help. And then I saw that I was just like her. So knowing that AA was around, I wasn't going back because I was terrified. At this point, I was walking through campus with my hat below my eyes, and I wasn't talking to anyone, and I couldn't speak. I just couldn't look at anyone in the eye, and I was terrified. And so I went online, and I was searching for, you know, fixes to alcoholism online. And I found a couple of things, and none of them really panned out. And they... I found this online sponsorship list with, it wasn't AA thing, but it was, you can email people who are sober or who weren't drinking, and you can email them back and forth, let them know you're having problems and stuff like that. And there was about 500 names, and I needed the perfect one I was going to email, so I read through all names. I found two people, one who was sober when she was 20, and she had 9 years of sobriety, and one who was sober a year who had... he also got sober young, so I emailed them both. And the woman that I emailed, who had 9 years sober, she took like a month and a half to email me back, and I was like, forget this. And I was home now from school, and I get an email from this woman, and I start reading it. And she shared her entire experience, strength, and hope in an email in just about 3 or 4 paragraphs. And I just remember, like, I was at a place where I'm like, nobody understands my drinking, really, and I really now am alone. And the feelings that I had in high school that I am just, I'm bored, but really I'm just alone, and people really don't understand me. But here was someone that actually understood me. She was, her drunk-a-log happened to be the same as mine. You know, woke up in strange places, strange people, fell down a lot, broke bones. And she just understood that, like, when she just wrote out, like, once I take a drink, I can't stop drinking. If I stop drinking for a couple of days, by the third day, I just get, I'm off a little bit, and the idea of taking a drink pops into my head, and I take a drink, not remembering what happened to me just a couple of days ago. I was like, yes, this was perfect. And she was perfect. She did it perfectly. She just told her drunk-a-log, and she waited for me to say, so how do you do this? You know, and so a month. I made her email me a month. I made her work for it. And finally, I was like, all right, how do you do this? And she's like, I call it the bomb. She dropped the AA bomb. She said she goes to AA. And it was like, I just kept thinking, I'm 19. I'm not going to AA. I can't do that. I remember I drank one more time. I had a whole bunch. I drove home. I was in Dix Hills, and I was driving back to Elmont, Long Island. And I was on the LIE, and I'm falling asleep at the wheel, and I got the music blasting, the windows down. I'm just trying to keep myself awake. I get home. I make it home. I crash into my bed, and I just thought that, like, I do the same thing over and over again. I pick up a drink. I don't stop drinking, and it's like, what's going to happen next? And then I emailed this woman. At this point, calling was out of the question. I didn't call people until I had about a year of sobriety. I emailed her, and she's like, go to a meeting, and I was like, okay, so I had one, I don't know what night this was, but 3 days later, I still didn't go to a meeting, I was at my brother's house, and I'm picking up a drink again, and I drank a beer, and that was my last drink, because I grabbed the second one out of the fridge, and I was like, I'm starting this one more time, here it goes again, and I just put the drink down. I only had one drink that night. The next day I went to a meeting, or it was again a couple of days later, I think it was, I went to a meeting, I actually put my hand up, which was not me, and I said I had X amount of days, and I don't know what I'm doing. And I got attacked by a whole bunch of women, and they did it like an Atlanta group. It was scary. But this one woman handed me a meeting list, circled the meeting, and I'll be there here tomorrow if you want to come. And that's what I needed. And I just followed this woman around. I didn't say much to her. I followed her around to meetings in Long Island, and I started counting days. That was July 30th. I counted days all through August. I went back to school for my junior year. And I had preseason, And this was my first God moment when I look back and try to trace my God path. It was like preseason was like lockdown. We were going to be in hotel rooms for 2 weeks, not on campus. And so there was like, you know, no meetings, nothing. And at this point, I called the woman that emailed me. She lived in Pennsylvania. And now I was talking to her on the phone, and I was comfortable with her. So my father shows up to the door one day, and he was like, I did a promo at work. Here's 200 calling cards. I don't know what to do with them. And so I took them, and I had a big book. And every night after soccer practice, I'd call the woman in Philadelphia, and we talked. And we had a plan that as soon as I was done, I was going to go right into the city. I was going to go to a meeting. My first meeting in the city was Chelsea Riverside, where I met this woman, Maria, who, again, didn't come up to me and say two words to me, thank God. She just handed me a note that said, I know of a great meeting, Tuesday night, 7 p.m., why don't you meet me here? And I was like, that works for me, you know. And I showed up, I sat next to her, I didn't say anything to her. And that's when I got to Atlantic Group, when I had about 30-something days. And I was terrified. I couldn't speak. My first couple years of sobriety, I love the word mocus. I didn't really know what it meant, but it just made sense. It was like, I was totally mocus. I don't know what that means, but it makes sense. But I looked it up. It means just an unconscious state. And that describes me perfectly for the first 2 years of my sobriety. I was in an unconscious state. I had no opinions, no feelings about anything. I couldn't call anyone because it was terrifying. I didn't want to talk to anybody because I couldn't speak. But I was in school, so I was good at doing homework. So I did all my steps. Maria became my first sponsor. She took me through the steps. I started to speak a little bit. My first friend in AA was Zulka. She's just waving her hand. And I felt like weird on the Tuesday night because I was like, I don't know anyone. How do I get to know anyone? And Zulka's just like, you go to the other Atlantic Group meetings, and that's how you get to know everyone. So I started going to all the Atlantic Group meetings, and it was just Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. So I went to all four Atlantic Group meetings. I was driving this car, this old car that I begged my mother. I used the therapist that got me into introduced me to AA to tell my mother I needed the car on campus to drive to AA meetings. So I was still a little working in a little bit, so I got my car on campus. And I was driving to meetings, and I'd drive Zulka home, and there was this other woman, Leona, who was in the group, and those were my two friends. I couldn't speak to anybody else. And it was perfect, because Zulka just moved here from Germany. So her English was as good as I could talk, which was like, you know what I mean? So it was perfect. So I drive her home. We didn't have to say anything, you know. And Leona just stopped. She couldn't stop talking, so you couldn't get a word in. So this was really, really working for me. When I had a year of sobriety, I got Stephanie as my sponsor, and we went through the steps again, and I started to clear up even more, but those first 2 years, my junior, my senior in college, I'd go to AA meetings, I'd go back to campus, I'd hang out with my lunatic roommates. One of them was alcoholic. Melissa in the group, she was my roommate in college, and I didn't think she was an alcoholic when we were, you know. And I'd go back and I'd hang out with them, and I was just blessed with these roommates because none of them, they barely drank. And I had a running buddy up at campus that was like, we were taking care of each other. And then I'd go to my meetings and I'd come back, it was working for me. And when I graduated college, I moved right in with Kelly of this group, the overly pregnant woman at the CD table. I moved in with her, and this is when my sober party started. You know what I mean? Kelly knew everyone, so I was like in. I was in. I was going to get friends. I was getting more friends. I still had Zulka. She'll always be my main person. And but Kelly was like running these parties in her apartment, and they were like crazy sober parties, and they were awesome, and it was lots of Red Bull and cigarettes, and you had a crush on everything that walked, and it was like those crushes turned into obsessions, and that was fun. And the fun just started, and then I started talking. I started talking again. And I was in the middle of my amends, was making amends and everything, and my first amends was, one of my first amends was my father. And my relationship with my father is like, it's still repairing. Every time he talked to me, I'd cringe. You know, and there was absolutely no, I just held so much resentment against, you know, the divorce thing that I had no feelings about. I had plenty of feelings when I got sober. And I held a lot of stuff against him and the way he treated my mother and the way he treated my brother and all this stuff. And every time he talked to me, I'd just cringe. Even if it was like, how was your day? It was like, oh, God. And I never called him back. I never called him. And I had such an attitude. And I made the amends, and it was like another, it was a painful one. And then it was junior year in college, it was. He called me up. He's like, do you want to go, you want to learn how to scuba dive with me? Because I want to learn, I need a buddy, and we'll go on vacation. So I was like, that's fine, because I like to do all that stuff. So I was like, all right, and he was paying. Couldn't really argue. And I started vacationing with my dad once a year with him for about 7 years into sobriety, 7 or 8 years into sobriety. And again, it was perfect because I didn't have to talk. It was like, you're scuba diving, you're under the water. And when you're out of the water, you're too tired. You know what I mean? And our relationship started based off of that. And he had asked, he had a lot of opinions about AA. My father's side of the family is a bunch of drunks. We're good, solid Irish drunks. And he just had a lot of opinions about AA. And I never argued with it. I just let it go. I just couldn't talk about it. And he just watched. He just watched me for 10 years. And last year, he called me up, and he caught me out of the blue, and he was like, your stepbrother is having a problem with alcohol. I know AA has worked for you. Can you help him? And it was like, I just, wow. He just kicked me off of my feet there. And my stepbrother is Russian. He doesn't speak English. He speaks English, but it's not great. And it was like, this group is amazing because I knew exactly who to go to. It was like, I went to Arena. She got me books in Russian. I created a little package for him, and he's been sober for a year. And it was like, this is just all God entering in my life and fixing everything. You know, my mother, my relationship has always been amazing. It had some, you know, reparations to be done, but, you know, that was easy. Some of the amends that I've made, I made an amends to Barnes & Nobles because I stole a whole bunch of CDs when I worked there. And I got to tell you, I stole them in my first 2 years of sobriety and books and all that stuff. And I had to go back and I tallied up all the money that I owed them and I walked in and I was terrified to make this amends because every time I rationalized, I'm like, I got to get a job first because they're going to haul me away for stealing CDs. This is what I'm thinking. So I put it off. Finally, I was like, I just got to go do this thing because it was like hanging over my head for sobriety. It was like, where's the freedom in that? So I walked in on a Sunday night. I had my wad of money. I was like, can I please speak to a manager? And the manager comes out, and she's terrifying looking. And she's like, can I help you? I was like, oh, boy, this is it, you know. And Melissa drove me. I was like, just keep the car running. I made the amends. I was like, I'm in a spiritual program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and in order to get over my drinking, I have to do the utmost to clear away the wreckage of my past, and for that, I owe you amends. When I worked here, I stole CDs and books to magazines, which equaled the amount of about $200, and I'm here to make the amends. And, oh my God, she goes, does Barnes & Nobles know about this? And I was like, oh, no. I was like, here it is. And I was like, no, and I almost lied. I was like, yes. They do. And I caught myself. I was like, no, they don't. And she's like, all right, well, I can't accept your money. Amends made. You're forgiven. Good day. And, you know, and I was like, well, I got to give the money to someone. So can I give it to a charity? Does that work for you? She's like, yeah, give it to a charity. Yeah, whatever. So I find the charity that's associated with the bookstore. It's Project Paperback or something like that. And it was like, you give money and they send books overseas. So I send my $200 in, and I get a nice letter back from the organization. And it was in that moment that promise. So I'm gonna mess it up. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we could see how our experience can benefit others. And I saw that in AA. I saw me giving my experience in AA, but now I saw it on the outside world. Like even the stuff I did benefits the outside world. Like yes, I gave money and I bought a whole bunch of books for some soldiers, but I just thought of that woman opening this envelope up randomly and getting $200 for her organization and the smile that she may have had or the like, oh, this is awesome type thing. And I was like, you know what, I cannot regret anything in my past because it always comes through, you know. And the second amends I made was awesome. This was recently. I was in San Antonio for the International. I was hanging out with Hannah for some reason. Not for some reason, but she was, well, I don't know what, we were in the lobby for whatever reason, and someone was like holding confetti eggs. And I don't know, I had confetti in my pockets of my jeans. For whatever reason, I forgot they were there. And I go, and I have to make this amends to this girl that I went to high school with. And I've been trying to nail this girl down for years, and she keeps inviting people to the to us meeting. And finally, I was like, can we just meet alone? She's like, sure. And then the day before we meet, she's like, oh, my friend Lisa, or Lisa's coming. And like, I knew Lisa too. And just in the last couple of days before she told me that, I realized I owed an amend to Lisa too. And I was like, all right, you know, but I was like, but I got to do this amends. And I was praying. I was like, if I'm meant to do this amends, give me the opportunity to do this. And I kept saying that over and over and over again. And all of a sudden, they don't know anything about AA. But it turned out that my friend's husband's mother has 30 years of sobriety in Long Island somewhere. And she starts talking about it. And I was like, all right, here's the opportunity. And I'm a little nervous. I'm not friends with these girls anymore, you know, and I'm moving around. I'm standing, I'm sticking my hands in my pocket, and I'm wearing the jeans that had the confetti in them. And I stick my hands in my pocket. I'm like, what is in my pocket? And it was like, oh, my God, this is disgusting. And I pull it out, and it's all the confetti eggs, the confetti and then the egg chips in my pocket. And it was like, I got nothing to worry about. I'm like, yes. I instantly thought of Hannah. And then I went and was like, I'm here to do a job. I just have to make my amends. There's nothing I need to be worried about, and I have to let go of the results. And this is how my program has always worked, is that I show up. I do the best I can. You know, my sponsor has always taught me how to suit up and show up appropriately. She's always showed me that when you show up, have the appropriate outfit on, bring the appropriate item or no item. You know, just always show up, but don't worry about the results, and you'll be taken care of. And as a result, this has been the easiest, softest way for me in sobriety. My relationships have repaired with nothing on my part except to show up, make an amends, and just smile. And, you know, it seems like hard work, but it really wasn't. And God steps in and he just does the rest. And I didn't believe in God until I had a couple of years of sobriety, just because I needed the experiences to see that wasn't me, that was God. That was scary. I got through it. I'm still alive, and I'm happier. And, you know, God is the solution to my alcoholism. And the program and the steps and my sponsor and all the little things we tell you to do here is what connects me to God. That's going to save me. And just thank you very much.